Hello and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks, part of the Learning College. Today we're going to do chapter 23, The Birth of Conservatism from the Jewish Revolutionary Spirit and Its Impact on World History by E. Michael Jones. Back in 2008 it was published. Jones is the foremost Catholic intellectual or apologist that I know of, at least, in the USA, maybe in the world, operating at this time. This is, again, a brief chapter. The endnotes aren't even worth looking at. If the sources are mentioned, they'll pop up in the text. This is may even be the shortest chapter in the book. It's just maybe 11, 12 pages. Let's see. Well, no, it's a little longer than that. It's about 19 pages. As always, you can find this archived at alexlinder.com, also at vnnforum.com. We have a whole bunch of audiobooks and other resources like PDFs there at VNN Forum. You can find on the sticky threads a sort of standing, always accumulating deep education that you can't get, certainly in any school in the U.S., under Jewish tyranny. So, chapter 23, The Birth of Conservatism. In 1947, Henry Regnery, scion of a wealthy Chicago industrialist who had been a pillar and major funder of the America First movement, founded a publishing house for the new, quote, conservatism espoused by Russell Kirk and William F. Buckley's. Kirk's The Conservative Mind and Buckley's God and Man at Yale appeared under the Regnery imprint in 1951. Of the two, Kirk was more original. Kirk created modern post-World War II conservatism by resurrecting the conservative Whiggery of Edmund Burke, emphasizing Burke's emphasis on local autonomy and the moral underpinnings of the social order, and omitting, as had Burke, mention of the Whigs setting the wheels in motion for the French Revolution. Like the Whigs of the early and mid-18th century, the American conservatives of the mid-20th century had a penchant for black operations. In 1955, 2 years after Irving Kristol became co-editor of Encounter, Buckley launched National Review, quote, which soon became a rallying point for the new conservatism. Years later, Ruvalo Oliver, who was an early contributor to National Review, again the racialist, would claim that it, like Encounter, was a CIA front. And that's interesting. I don't think I've come across that particular claim, but we're going to do America's Decline. Were too long. And again, Revelo Oliver, remember what we heard last chapter about these Jews in the Office of War Information, OSS, etc., developed these psychological warfare techniques, turned them into social engineering to alter the white mind through the use of propaganda in these various media productions like South Pacific and Invasion of the Body Snatchers were two he specifically mentioned last chapter, but you know, you can see in the movies of the 50s all kinds of social engineering. But also we know that the CIA was funding all kinds of different publications, these Jew anti-communist publications. And the Jews come into the right, and I guess Revelo Oliver is saying that they were more or less there from the start. Murray Rothbard, an irrepressible libertarian who grew up among the messianic Jewish sects of New York City, also felt NR was a CIA front. As Rothbard and others have made clear, the CIA was always in the business of media manipulation. Not long after the Central Intelligence Agency was founded in 1947, Rothbard writes, the American public and the world were subjected to an unprecedented level of propaganda in the service of U.S. foreign policy objectives in the Cold War. At its peak, the CIA allocated 29% of its budget to media and propaganda. Because of intense internecine communist hatred, the Trotskyites were willing, if not positively eager, to grasp the levers of the anti-Stalinist propaganda machine. According to Rothbard, the neoconservatives, quote, moved from cafeteria Trotskyites to apologists for the U.S. warfare state without missing a beat. The CIA established the Congress for Cultural Freedom as its premier anti-Stalinist organization, but that organization's credibility was destroyed when it became known it was a CIA front. James Burnham, a former Trotskyite and CIA agent who founded National Review, and that's the guy who was Sam Francis's tutor, worked for the Congress. He was also a former Trotskyite and a CIA agent. When Peter Coalmont, or Coalmant, Coleman with a T in the end, exposed Encounter as a CIA front operation in his largely sympathetic book, The Liberal Conspiracy, Irving Kristol, the father of neoconservatism, at first denied knowing that Encounter was a CIA front. Later in his autobiography, he admitted knowing that the CIA was involved, but tried to play down the scale of his involvement. Rothbard, however, felt that Kristol was being disingenuous, if not downright dishonest. As Rothbard points out, Tom Braden, then head of the CIA's International Organizations Division, he would later go on to do a show with Pat Buchanan, wrote in a Saturday Evening Post article, a CIA agent always served as the editor of Encounter. If National Review, like Encounter, was a CIA front, what purpose did it serve? National Review existed to destroy competing conservatisms, especially those incompatible with the internationalist foreign policy establishment. National Review used conservatism to mobilize certain ethnic groups, e.g. Catholics, behind government policies. It existed to colonize certain groups, to divide and conquer, and then get them to act against their own interests. NR was created to destroy isolationist conservatism. Conservatives who criticized America's march to empire were demonized and decertified. National Review has shown undeviating consistency in this regard, the most recent example being David Frum's diatribe against the paleoconservatives, unpatriotic conservatives, in the March 19, 2003 issue. Again, he's writing in 2008, or that's when this was published. According to Rothbard, the idea for National Review originated with Willie Schlamm, a hardline interventionist and feature editor with the old right Freeman, who was, quote, at odds with the isolationism of the right. Friend of the Buckley family, Revelo Oliver, said National Review, quote, was conceived as a way to put the isolationist Freeman out of business. A surreptitious deal was cut with one of the Freeman editors, presumably Willie Schlamm, to turn the magazine over to Buckley. By 1955, and notice Jones is citing the racialist Revelo Oliver, by 1955, when National Review was launched, Buckley had long been a CIA agent. In his biography of Buckley, Judas claims Buckley served under E. Howard Hunt in Mexico City in 1951. Rothbard claims Buckley was directed to the CIA by Yale professor Wilmore Kendall, who introduced him to James Burnham, then a consultant to the Office of Policy Coordination, the CIA's covert action wing. While at Yale, Buckley had served as a campus informant for the FBI, feeding, Rothbard says, God only knows what, to Hoover's political police. Buckley's sister Priscilla also worked for the CIA, as did almost everyone associated with the founding National Review, including William Casey, who would later head the CIA, and he made some comment about how they owned every significant journalist out there. Casey drew up its legal documents. Of the $500,000 needed to launch National Reviews, $100,000 came from Buckley's father. The source of the rest of the funding is unknown. Frank Meyer, author of the fusionist ideology that informed NR, confided privately to Rothbard that he believed National Review was a CIA front, as fusing libertarian market economics with traditional conservative, morals, and the anti-communist foreign policy. In his History of Neoconservatism, the Neoconservative Revolution, Jewish Intellectuals, and the Shaping of Public Policy, Murray Friedman claims even more convincingly that National Review was run by Jews. As the career of Irving Kristol demonstrates, we are not talking about mutually exclusive alternatives here. Following the lead of Jewish organizations like the AJC and the ADL and their avid support of America's anti-communist crusade, many American Jews went to work just as avidly for the CIA as their parents and grandparents had worked for the Cheka. National Review could grow out of and absorb the Freeman because that magazine had already been absorbed by conservative Jewish activists like Frank Meyer, Frank Chodorov, Maury Raskin, and Willie Schlamm. Schlamm was originally in German. I guess he was a Jew, too. In this regard, young Yale graduates Buckley and L. Brent Bozell, his brother-in-law to be, were both junior partners and Goyish frontmen in the venture. Friedman calls Willie Schlamm one of the forgotten Jewish godfathers of National Review. Schlamm worked at Time, but hearing that Buckley had access to funding suggested that he bring out an opinion magazine. With the promise of $100,000 from Buckley's father, Schlamm co-wrote the business plan that drew in the other investors. Buckley later described Schlamm, who possessed, quote, all the patronizing charm of the Viennese cafe intellectual, along with the cultural solemnity of the Jew brought up under German culture, as one of, quote, his two closest partners in founding NR. The other was Sidney Hook's protege, James Burnham. So Sidney Hook to James Burnham to Sam Francis. You wonder why they have trouble spotting the Jew or describing the Jew as a problem? And James Burnham, also a CIA agent. Friedman notes, although National Review has often been characterized as militantly Catholic and Irish Catholic, five Jews served on the original editorial board, including Meyer and Schlamm. Buckley's circle of Jews included Frank Chodorov, who appointed Buckley president of the Intercollegiate Society of Individualists, later changed to the Intercollegiate Studies Institute, only to remove him because it was easier to raise money if a Jew is president. ISI would produce neoconservative activists like Edwin J. Feulner, Jr., later president of the Heritage Foundation. That was big when I was out there in the 80s, the third wave conservatism, it was called. Heritage was a big thing for young conservatives. And Irving Kristol's son, William, who would become Vice President Quayle's chief of staff and editor of the neocon flagship, the Weekly Standard. Another of Buckley's circle of Jews was Frank Meyer, whose fusionism was the philosophical underpinning for National Review. Meyer was a student of Lewis Wirth at the University of Chicago. Like Wirth, the guy who wrote Gunnar Myrdal's An American Dilemma, so a Swedish front guy for an actual Jew leftist who intends to destroy ethnic parishes and Catholicism around the major cities and promote the destruction of the free association as practiced via housing covenants to protect white neighborhoods from blacks. So left-right matter less than Jew and a Jew agenda. Okay, so another of Buckley's circle of Jews, in quotes, was Frank Meyer, whose fusionism was the philosophical underpinning for National Review. Meyer was a student of Lewis Wirth at the University of Chicago. Like Wirth, he was a Stalinist who had second thoughts. The result was fusionism, an eclectic ideology that sought to combine the best, or least incompatible, elements of the conservative movement. As senior editor at National Review, Meyer tried to combine the libertarianism of the Randians and the Austrian school with the traditionalism of Russell Kirk in his column Principles and Heresies. The only thing that kept this radically incoherent mixture together was anti-communism, and when communism fell apart in 1989, conservatism fell apart too. What conservatism lacked in philosophical coherence, it made up for in organizing techniques its founding Jewish fathers remembered from their days in the Communist Party or in Zionist terrorist organizations. The most influential organizer in Buckley's circle of Jews was Marvin Liebman, is it queer, a former communist who came to conservatism via Zionism, in particular via the terrorist organization Irgun Zvi Lumi, or Loimi, L-U-M-I. Irgun, I-R-G-U-N, Zvi, Z-V-A-I, Lumi, L-E-U-M-I. In 1946, Marvin Liebman was captured smuggling Jews into Palestine and held in a British detention camp on Cyprus for 15 days. When the Korean War killed his enthusiasm for communism, Liebman discovered conservatism. Liebman created a public relations firm that fronted for anti-communist crusades, and it was in this capacity that he became the moving force behind the publishing of National Review. It was Liebman who mobilized the young Republicans who were disillusioned in the aftermath of Nixon's defeat in 1960 into Young Americans for Freedom, and it was Liebman, with the help of YAF, who mobilized New York for Barry Goldwater in 1964. It was Liebman who invited those activists to his farm in Sharon, Connecticut, for a meeting that issued the Sharon Statement, which was more influential than the more well-known Port Huron statement of the SDS, Students for a Democratic Society. That was Mark Hayden, Irish Catholic, and a bunch of Jews. That was their statement, student radicals. Liebman's Sharon statement was a philosophically incoherent blend of traditionalism and libertarianism, held together by anti-communism and political organizing. Liebman, according to Friedman, was the key figure in the creation of what one historian has called, quote, the most important organizational initiative undertaken by conservatives in the last 30 years. Buckley, often credited with founding YAF, credited Liebman, saying, my midwifery, some pronounce it, was purely ceremonial. Much of what is attributed to William F. Buckley was the work of Jewish thinkers and financiers who, working behind the scenes, created a foil to the socialism that held the allegiance of the majority of American Jews. Buckley was the Goyish frontman for Trotskyite conservatism, in the same way Gus Hall was the Goyish frontman for American communism. Hall reportedly was chosen to head the Communist Party in America because he was the only member who didn't have a Brooklyn accent. Buckley's role, however, was more specific and more related to his Catholic identity. Buckley was the ideological enforcer who would pronounce the political cherem, C-H-E-R-E-M, on competing conservative sects and expel them from the synagogue. He was also the model for the Catholics he was to control by transforming them from recalcitrant ethnics into docile movement conservatives. And the professional conservatism that I saw when I went out there was very much dominated by Catholics. The ideological agenda was certainly set by Jews, and half the writers were Jews, but people in the actual office were almost all Catholics, almost all. In fact, I actually believe that I was more or less hired as an intern by the woman who did, because I was not a Catholic, but actually had a Protestant background. Which is ironic, isn't it? But yeah, very, very Catholic professional conservatism, but only the outward part of it. Again, the ideas and the agenda that are being enforced come from Jews. Now, you know, and at this point, I had never heard of E. Michael Jones. I didn't know any of this. I just knew that I thought the right was honest and opposed to the left. That's what being young and naive will get you. But now you have the internet, so you can find this out more quickly. Now, okay, to repeat that sentence, he was also the model for the Catholics he was to control by transforming them from recalcitrant. So he's modeling, look, I've become a docile movement conservative, you should too, not a Catholic ethic. Buckley's most important contribution to the conservative movement, Friedman says, was his purge of its most extreme and bigoted elements. Conservatism, he wrote, must be wiped of the parasitic cant that defaces it. Never a deep thinker, Buckley relied on Jews for the heavy lifting, whether getting him subscribers, Liebman, or coming up with a conservative philosophy, Meyer. Buckley's job was to serve as a model for the Catholic students from Villanova and Fordham who flocked to the YAF. His other job was to destroy any conservative movement not towing the line of the internationalist establishment. All forms of isolationism were anathema. It also meant an all-out attack on anything anti-Semitic. In October 1965, National Review attacked the John Birch Society using Barry Goldwater and Frank Meyer to claim, quote, the Birch Society's psychosis of conspiracy threatened American interests. The attack, according to Friedman, proved to be a critical moment in the development of a more responsible conservative movement. Shortly after dispatching the Birchers in 65, Buckley received his own TV show, Firing Line, which he used to attack George Wallace, then a significant threat to the two-party monopoly. Buckley also attacked Ayn Rand and Objectivism, which Whitaker Chambers portrayed as a competing sect that was the mirror image of Soviet communism. Chambers, in an NR piece, Big Sister is Watching You, likened Randian man to Marxian man. Each was the center of a godless world. From almost any page of Atlas Shrugged, a voice can be heard commanding, to a gas chamber, go! Rand fired back, denouncing National Review as the worst and most dangerous magazine in America. In 2003, Alan Greenspan, a Randian, was still critical of Buckley. Quote, someone has finally defined the rational morality underlying capitalism, the economic savant wrote, and you treat it in such a vulgar manner. Some of the Jews associated with Buckley at National Review eventually converted to Catholicism. Friedman claims that all of the Jews associated with NR were philo-Catholic without stating what was equally obvious, namely that Buckley undermined the Catholic positions on the crucial issues of the age, from contraception to economics, under the motto, Mater Si, Magistra, no. He was also the agent of choice when it came to blacklisting and or publicly denouncing Catholics who dared to stray from the conservative reservation. Talking about them the way they talk about blacks and liberals. National Review's purpose was to purge, quote, bad conservatives by running the conservative blacklist. The first to go were isolationists and anyone with residual sympathies for the America First movement, including followers of Father Coughlin. Then the John Birch Society was purged. Then the Ayn Rand cult. Then Joe Sobern and Pat Buchanan after Buckley denounced them as anti-Semites. Most recently, David Frum excommunicated paleoconservatives as traitors during the run-up to the war in Iraq. Paleocon columnist Sam Francis was purged as a columnist at the Washington Times, largely because of Buckley's efforts. Before his death, Francis claimed Buckley was responding to a memo from the ADL. Before long, it became clear that conservatism became whatever certain Jews defined as conservatism, and any conservatism who disagreed was being expelled from the synagogue of organizations like the Philadelphia Society by being labeled an anti-Semite. Russell Kirk, founder of the conservative movement, experienced Midge Dechter's ire when he bemoaned Jewish influence in the movement. Even the Philo-Catholic Jews at National Review were unable to get beyond the rhetoric of messianic revolutionary politics and unable to tolerate anyone who disagreed with their essentially Talmudic understanding of conservatism. After Richard Nixon's presidential nomination, Frank Meyer lectured a group of students on the difference between real and false conservatism. Real conservatism was Jewish. Real conservatism was Talmudic. Real conservatism was revolutionary. Or as Friedman puts it, quote, Meyer declared, in a manner Jewish neoconservatives would adopt later, quote, a revolutionary force had shattered, quote, the unity and balance of civilization. Conservatism should not be limited to an uncomplicated reverence for the past, which is the essence of natural conservatism. The conscious conservative, he proclaimed, was required to become, in a non-pejorative sense, an ideologue, with a clear understanding of how principles and institutions and men affect each other to form a culture and a society. All right, now, that was great stuff. 1955, Ramblin' Jack Elliott heads for England as we turn on to page 868. And again, this only goes up to like 882, so it's not all that long. But it's very deep, rich. Rich in this case, just facts. Facts, like, wow, NR is a... Here's old me listening to WFB and shaking his hand and gushing praise and how great it was. Actually, it was great. But what it wasn't was what it appeared to be. Because I didn't know any of this. You know? If you're not that smart and can't figure things out, you gotta have it explained to you, don't you? And that's the point of the learning college. I wasn't smart enough to figure any of this out on my own, pre-internet, not having any adults to tell it to me. So I doubt most people would be. 1955, Ramblin' Jack Elliott heads for England. In 1955, Ramblin' Jack left for England, which was going through the skiffle craze, became a sensation overnight. Wiz Jones remembers him strutting around Piccadilly Circus in his cowboy outfit. Remember, he's originally a Jew who changed his name. He was larger than life. With his cowboy boots and hat, he would stop traffic. But one day we realized that he really wasn't what he claimed to be. He was Elliot Adnopause. And one day his mother and father came to the gig. That's amazing. Instead of being disillusioned, Jones was filled with admiration for Adnopause posturing as a cowboy because it proved to a generation of Englishmen, including Mick Jagger, Keith Richards, Donovan, John Lennon, and Rod Stewart, you can choose to be whatever you want to be. You can turn your back on your roots. You don't have to be what your parents wanted you to be. The generation born to the communist New York Jews during the 1930s and 40s came to be known as red diaper babies. Their parents didn't want them to grow up to be cowboys. They wanted them to grow up to be decent, upstanding Jewish communists like Julius and Ethel Rosenberg. And to ensure that this would happen, The communists and their fellow travelers created a group of summer camps in the Catskills where they would be sheltered from the red-baiting of the Irish Catholics who taught them in New York's public school system. These summer camps were the laboratory in which the new personal lifestyle was created. In the late 1940s, Ron Radosh attended Camp Woodland for Children, one of the myriad alternative institutions founded by the Communist Party in its effort to construct an alternative to America. Woodland was technically independent, although, Radosh notes, it drew its staff from the communist world. The most radical of all the Catskill red diaper baby camps was Camp Wochika, a name derived from the first syllables of the words Workers' Children's Camp. Campers recited a pledge to combat the influence of jokes, comic books, newspapers, radio programs that make fun of any people. As the anti-comic book pledge makes clear, the Jewish communists of the 1940s seemingly had more in common with the Legion of Decency than with, say, the Fugs, a Reichian sex pal band, rock band formed in the 60s by Tuli Kupferberg, which is to say, by their own children. Kupfer is copper in German, Berg is mountain. Camp Kinderland, kinder is children, of course, like a kindergarten. Camp Kinderland was more Jewish in its orientation. It tried to hand on, quote, to the children of Eastern European Jewish immigrants, the legacy of the secular Jewish radical culture developed in the old country. Camp Kinderland featured an appearance by the widow of the Yiddish writer Sholem Aleichem, whose portraits of shtetl life in Poland became the basis for the musical hit Fiddler on the Roof, as well as, quote, modern dance classes led by Martha Graham protege Edith Segal, a hardcore communist who tried to blend modern dance with Marxism. Soviet holidays were Jewish holidays for Jewish communists who lived in this milieu. Radosh recounts a joke. Quote, what Jewish holidays do you celebrate? The answer, Paul Robeson's birthday and May Day. May Day is May the 1st, the Day of the Workers. When Radosh joined the Communist Party, the reasons had little to do with politics and a great deal to do with the need to find an identity. He could just as easily have said that communism was part of his ethnic identity as a New York Jew. Communism was a way of being a Jew. The Labor Youth League offered the camaraderie of a tight-knit group of ready-made friends along with a sense of moral superiority because it was ethnically homogenous, something he takes up at another point in the same narrative when he says, quote, most of the members of the Upper West Side LYL were all Jewish. A salient aspect of the communist organization was, quote, a purely cultural Yiddish kite that emphasized Yiddish literature and theater, the folk writing of Sholem Aleichem, the parables of freedom that abounded throughout Jewish culture, and most important, a complete rejection of anything to do with religion. More important than Jewish religion were Jewish morals, which were in a flux during Radosh's teen years. The LYL, says Radosh, offered the possibility of what every teenage boy seeks, a girlfriend. God bless the communist movement for giving me my very first sexual experiences from among a group of liberated girls whom I found time to romance. Radosh makes light of his generation's sexual experiences, but they would have far-reaching consequences for the left. The subverters were unwittingly subverted by their own penchant for subversion. At the Upper West Side chapter of the LYL, Radosh met David Horowitz, who had become his lifelong friend, introducing him late in life to the Jewish subversion known as neoconservatism. See, these are the ex-radicals who had the second thoughts. Radosh, a big associate of Horowitz, who worked with a goy, actually, Peter, I forget his last name. Front Page Mag, freed from the constraints imposed on them by the then largely anti-communist public schools, counselors at Camp Woodland could promote progressive education, quote-unquote, which Radosh says meant the creation of a new personality to fit the new kind of culture we saw developing in America. At Camp Woodland, the Jews learned they were in America, but not of it. The counselors were, quote, to liberate children not from their parents, but from America. Because if the camp liberated campers from their parents, they would have no longer been communists. The Jews sent their children to Camp Woodland to internalize what the camp director called the, quote, new emerging culture of democracy, which meant the ethos of the Popular Front, the Communist Party's attempt to domesticate itself after the disastrous Revolutionary Third Period, when it had demanded a break with liberals and social democrats. Camp Woodland was creating the new socialist man, a new democratic personality that was, quote, molded to fit the socialized paradise to come. Since its educational philosophy was based on the Popular Front, folk music played a major role at Camp Woodland. There, Radosh met Pete Seeger, again, who is not a Jew, but from an old Puritan line up in the Northeast, who also had a lasting effect in his life, determining what instrument he played and the politics that went along with it. According to Radosh, quote, "The highlight of many Sunday meetings was to have Seeger gather before the camp at the outdoor amphitheater, where he first sang what would much later become hits for the Weavers, including his version of Lead Belly's Goodnight Irene and Kisses Sweeter Than Wine. The camaraderie one felt in sitting with friends and singing the beautiful words and melodies produced a belief that all would be good in the world, and that the lovely music we were creating would help us build that better world. Better world." Largely because of the Catskill commie summer camps, folk music became the revolutionary lingua franca for a generation of Jewish revolutionaries. Quote, "I'm convinced that much of the radicalism that Woodlanders would carry with them in later years came from the illusions they developed as a result of the weekly sing-alongs with Seeger. Songs are weapons," he often said. And during the years of commercial Top 40 hit parade, before rock and roll, songs were helping us to build an alternative culture mirroring the alternative politics that Seeger was trying to create during the 1948 presidential campaign, when he accompanied Henry A. Wallace throughout the country and sang wherever Wallace appeared for his new Progressive Party. Seeger also educated a generation of predominantly Jewish five-string banjo pickers like John Cohen of the new Lost City Ramblers and Eric Weisberg, whose dueling banjos became a hit from the movie Deliverance. Summer 1959. Alice and Ron Radosh got married in the summer of 1959. Before heading off to one more left-wing Jewish folk music enclave at the University of Iowa, they spent an extended honeymoon at Wingdale on the lake. It was not a good omen for their marriage. Arriving in Iowa, the Radoshes found a ready-made community, namely the bohemian and political fringe at the university's first off-campus Greenwich Village-style coffee shop. There, Radosh met poet Bob Mezzi, a master guitar picker and folk singer, and Saul Stern, later editor at the 60s icon Ramparts. And that's where David Horowitz was also. Stern, Radosh says, was another New York Jew who had attended the City College of New York and had been active in its left-wing milieu. So these Jews all spread out to all these state schools like Madison, Ann Arbor, and even University of Iowa. Yeah, and that's exactly what he says. Now, by now, so these CCNY Jews from the Trotsky and Stalinist alcoves are spreading out around the country. By now, says Jones, the Jewish left-wing milieu had outposts in almost every university town in the country, a network that promoted folk music, proletarian chic clothing, sexual liberation, and radical politics ad libitum. Folk music, pro-slob dressing, sex liberation, and radical politics. Radosh could differ with Stern, who ridiculed my orthodoxy, but they shared the same basic socialist assumptions. Even that misstates the case. They shared cultural and ethnic assumptions that would make the revolution of the 60s as inevitable as it made the politics of their fathers irrelevant. Radosh and Stern were revolutionary Jews, and they had a nationwide network of folk music coffee houses from which to promote revolution. The other details were irrelevant. More importantly, the music at those coffee houses would soon be promoted by the mainstream, magnifying the revolutionary effect, bringing revolution to the children of the Goyim, who thought they were listening to an authentic alternative to Nelson Riddle arrangements of Frank Sinatra. The situation in Philadelphia was no different from that in Madison, Wisconsin, or Ames, Iowa. The Philadelphia Folk Song Society was formed in 1957 by a group who mirrored the Philadelphia ADA, i.e. left-wing Jews and WASPs, united to keep the city from falling into the hands of Catholic ethnics. And again, Jones himself is personally from around Philadelphia, I believe. That's where he started, and he was in the art world, art museums. The Jews ran the folk music clubs, the Gilded Cage, run by Ed and Esther Halpern, and the Second Fret, run by Manny, quote, Money Rubin, and the premier radio show in town, hosted by Gene Shea, whose real name was Ivan Shaner. They quickly took over the movement and redefined it to suit their tastes as a vehicle for cultural revolution. Shaner was born into a Russian Jewish family in the Nicetown section of Philadelphia, where his father owned a women's lingerie store. Shaner was drawn to jazz after World War II, but then he met Ken Goldstein, who in 1959 became a professor of anthropology at the University of Pennsylvania. Goldstein had the most impressive folk record collection in town and exerted enormous influence. Goldstein was instrumental in creating the Philadelphia Folk Festival in 1962. He also arranged recording contracts, and from his position at the University of Pennsylvania, he had a major say over how things ethnic got defined in Philadelphia. Ken, according to one folk devotee, put Philadelphia on the map as a folk city. Goldstein determined one doesn't find traditional musicians in Philadelphia, so he imported acts from the network of clubs across the country, but largely from New York. Ironically, Philadelphia, because of its traditionalism, was a bastion of traditional Jewish music. Klezmer didn't mutate in Philadelphia as it had in New York, but in the late 50s, klezmer didn't count as traditional, which, paradoxically, had become a synonym for revolutionary. When he met Ken Goldstein, Ivan Shaner switched from promoting jazz to promoting folk. He changed his name, too. In those days, Shaner explained later, ethnic names had to be changed. Since Shaner found myself getting into Anglo-American folk music, Scottish ballads, etc., he adopted the Scotch-Irish-sounding Shea, which also referred cryptically to the first syllable of Shaner. And remember, Shea's Rebellion, which is from up in that area. I found I liked traditions, explained Shea ironically, the Jewish tradition of changing your name to fool people and make money. Through Goldstein, Shaner met Tossie Aaron and ended up managing her career. Her albums, Jewish Folk Songs for the Second Generation and Tossie Sings American Folk Songs and Ballads, evince, we are told, quote, an original Philadelphia folk sound. It was Ivan Shaner who brought Bob Dylan to Philadelphia. Original name Zimmerman, original name Shaner, come Shea, come Dylan. For his first performance there, he brought Dylan to Philadelphia. While in town, Dylan and his girlfriend stayed at Tossie Aaron's house. 1961, Bob Dylan arrives in New York. After Bob Dylan signed his first contract with Columbia Records, someone from the publicity department, whom Dylan identifies as Bill, quote, dressed Ivy League like he could have come out of Yale, interviewed Dylan for material to promote the album. To get Dylan to cough up some facts, Bill asked Dylan about his family, where they were, etc., only to find that the 19-year-old folk singer had, quote, no idea, telling Bill that they were long gone. This was untrue. He was a Jew Jewing. Mr. and Mrs. Zimmerman, Bob's parents, were alive and well in Hibbing, Minnesota. He had spoken with them recently on the phone. Dylan said he had just arrived in New York City via boxcar, which was also not true. He had driven there with students from Minneapolis, where he had been a student and a part of the folk scene. The reference to the boxcar set up the best question. Quote, what kind of music do you play? Bill asked. Without batting an eye, Dylan responded, folk music. When Bob Dylan uttered the term, folk music was another word for Jewish cosmopolitanism or deracination. Bob Dylan, according to Bob Spitz, one of his many biographers, was haunted by his lack of roots. Dylan claimed little connection to an ancestral bloodline and changed his name, settling on the first name of a Welsh poet who died of alcohol poisoning. Dylan says the one thing he, quote, didn't have too much of was a concrete identity. So he made one up from snatches of folk songs. I'm a rambler, I'm a gambler, I'm a long way from home. That pretty much summed it up, is how Dylan described his concrete identity or lack thereof in his autobiography. Dylan would claim he was an orphan, and he would deny being Jewish. At another point, he accused the disapproving mother of a girlfriend of being an anti-Semite because she didn't view him as the ideal son-in-law. There was, of course, a certain amount of irony in this because by the time he arrived in New York City in January of 1961, folk music had become pretty much a Jewish enterprise, certainly in New York City. Bob Dylan was a genius at creating and projecting an image. Let's see. He was also the quintessential Jewish folk singer, but that image involved a certain amount of crypsis, lest the idea become a source of mirth rather than mystery. Myth was Dylan's only reality. Fabrication of image, mythic or not, was in some sense a necessity because Dylan was a third-generation Jew, i.e. a Jew on whom the triple melting pot had done its work. Bob's grandparents came from Odessa in Russia. But his grandmother, his only surviving link to that past, was living in Duluth, a predominantly Polish patchwork of ethnic neighborhoods typical of cities across the northern tier of the United States. Bob Dylan's ethnic identity was now dependent on religion, not country of origin, and since he had no religion to speak of, he had to create identity out of the materials at hand. That meant music because he aspired to be a musician, and in particular it meant constructing an identity out of snatches from the folk songs of the 60s. Bob offhandedly indicates his musical heritage was Polish, most certainly not Appalachian Scotch-Irish, whose deracinated derivative passed as folk music when he arrived in New York. Polka dances, Dylan says, always got my blood pumping. That was the first type of loud live music I'd ever heard. On Saturday nights, the taverns were filled with polka bands. Dylan would not say this after he was famous. It was not hip to be pro-polka in New York in 1961, especially among those Dylan wanted to impress. Israel Young ran the Folklore Center, the citadel of Americana folk music. Young, an old-line folk enthusiast, was very sardonic and wore heavy horn-rimmed glasses, spoke in a thick Brooklyn dialect. His center was, quote, a crossroads junction for all the folk activity you could name, and you might at any time see real hardline folk singers in there. Bob Dylan wanted to become a real hardline folk singer like the lapsed Catholic from Brooklyn, Dave Van Ronk, R-O-N-K, who showed up at the Folklore Center during Dylan's conversation with Izzy Young. Dylan would not be satisfied being a second-rate Dave Van Ronk. He wanted to become a second-rate Elvis Presley, or better, he wanted to become the Elvis Presley of folk singers. To do that, he had to impress Izzy Young, and to do that, he had to keep his mouth shut about the polka joints in Duluth and Hibbing. Dylan wasn't going to become famous as Elvis by playing polkas. After Dylan scandalized the folk world in 1965 by playing amplified instruments at the Newport Folk Festival, Young, the folk music maven, said in Sing Out, the magazine, "Next year he'll be writing rhythm and blues songs. When they get high on the charts, the following year the Polish polka will make it, and then he'll write them too." By 2004, Dylan was so hip he was beyond hip. He could even say he liked polkas. It was clear that he could not say this in 1961, not if he wanted to make it in New York City. But that doesn't mean ethnic connections weren't helpful. Bob Dylan told his first New York girlfriend, Susie Rotolo, that he was an orphan who, quote, had run away from his foster parents in Fargo, North Dakota. Might have been a good line for picking up chicks, but he had something more sophisticated for Young as he thumbed through a lot of his antediluvian folk scrolls at the Folklore Center. When Izzy asked me about my family, Dylan talked about his grandmother from Odessa. I told him about my grandma on my mom's side who lived with us. It was easy to string along a dumb goy like Bill from Yale, but Jewish identity had its perks when played right. Dylan's identity had to appeal to those who controlled the media and the folk song establishment. This meant coming up with something Jewish, but cryptically so. Dylan was the consummate artist of identity. Dylan was in the, quote, long tradition in show business that permits a performer to adopt an ethnic identity, not necessarily his own. As Al Jolson put on blackface, so Bob Dylan put on a whiteface, literally, during his days with the Rolling Thunder Review. Figuratively, the scion of Odessa Jews put on both blackface and whiteface in his search for a compelling, marketable identity. First blackface, as, according to Spitz, he embodied Little Richard's black gospel performance, and then whiteface, as he imitated Okie Woody Guthrie. It soon became impossible to distinguish the mask from the face behind it. So the Jew is very able to emulate and imitate others for profit. Political and commercial and financial. The most obvious identity for Bob Dylan in the early 60s, the singing Jewish cowboy, had already become a standing joke that got Letty Bruce lots of laughs. Dylan had to come up with something more subtle without disguising himself so thoroughly that he would lose the benefit of knowing Izzy Young and Irwin Silber and all the other singing Jewish cowboys. So Bob Dylan went to work assembling an identity from the sources available. There was, of course, Woody Guthrie, but there was also, at least according to autobiography, Bertolt Brecht, a Bertus Magnus, who seemed like a guy who couldn't sleep, writing this stuff late at night, clothes stuck to his clammy body, Sophocles, who wrote the Oedipus trilogy, but who, according to Dylan, was the author of a book on the nature and function of the gods, which also explained why there were only two sexes, and, of course, Thucydides. How could we leave out Thucydides? Albertus Magnus, Dylan the polymath tells us, was a lightweight compared to Thucydides. Dylan never explains the link binding Albertus Magnus and Thucydides, except that translations of their books sat next to each other on some bookshelf in some apartment in Greenwich Village. However, when Dylan expounds on the influence of other seminal figures, a pattern emerges. Picasso, he says, had fractured the art world and cracked it wide open. He was a revolutionary. I wanted to be like that. Dylan projected as much into this disparate group of thinkers as he drew from them. He drew from them what he thought would play well with Izzy Young. That meant, in short, a penchant for revolution. Dylan says he spent long hours hanging out with Liam Clancy of the Clancy Brothers at the White Horse Tavern on Hudson Street, Jack Kerouac's hangout 10 years earlier, which by the 60s had become, quote, mainly an Irish bar frequented mostly by guys from the old country. Bob was thus exposed to another form of ethnic music as genuine as the polkas. Dylan says, all through the night, he and the Clancys and their Irish buddies would sing drinking songs, country ballads, and rousing rebel songs that would lift the roof. Ever the chameleon, Dylan was beginning to think I might want to change over, i.e. become Irish. But he restrained himself because the Irish landscape wasn't too much like the American landscape. Before he could appropriate ethnic Irish music, he would have to find some cuneiform tablets, some archaic grail, to lighten the way. Sick. Lighten sick the way. Dylan discovered in the Irish music of the White Horse what he had already discovered in Picasso, namely revolution. The rebellion songs, Dylan says, were a really serious thing. The language was flashy and provocative. A lot of action in the words, all sung with great gusto. They weren't protest songs, though. They were rebel ballads. Even in simply melodic wooing ballad, there'd be rebellion waiting around the corner. You couldn't escape it. Rebellion spoke to me louder. The rebel was alive and, well, romantic and honorable. Like Captain Ahab, who stared at the coin he nailed to the mast and saw it in it only himself. That's the coin he was going to give to whoever spotted the white whale that he's looking for. And it was him who found it, actually. Bob Dylan sailed to New York, and everywhere he looked, he saw the revolutionary Jew staring back at him. Dylan was the 60s version of Jay Gatsby, another Jew who reinvented himself according to American myths and expectations. If you take America and place the Clancy brothers on... I never realized that Gats was supposed to be a Jew, because he came from the Midwest. That's interesting. And changed his name from Gats to Gatsby. Dylan was the 60s version of Jay Gatsby, another Jew who reinvented himself according to American myths and expectations. If you take America and place the Clancy brothers on top of it, and place Woody Guthrie on top of that, and place Picasso over him, what you come up with is revolution. The only persona, what Dylan calls the archaic grail, that could unite these disparate personae, like Camille Paglia's sexual personae, was the revolutionary Jew. Suddenly, the singing Jewish cowboy had become plausible in a way Lenny Bruce could not understand. Bob Dylan took the popular front persona Woody Guthrie had created and updated it to meet the exigencies of college students plunging toward the sexual revolution. But the persona of the revolutionary folk singer didn't begin with Woody Guthrie. It began with Joe Hill, the Swedish immigrant who fought in Mexico and later wrote songs for the Wobblies. Joe, Dylan says, wrote the song Pie in the Sky and was the forerunner of Woody Guthrie. That was all I needed to know. New York, 1961. As we have seen, when Bob Dylan arrived in New York in 1961, he found a world as avid to publish his fantasies as he was to spin them. New York Times folk music critic Robert Shelton was Dylan's most avid acolyte. Spitz says, Shelton played the indulgent straight man as Bob shoveled it on thick. Dylan recounted the, I'm a rambler, I'm a gambler, I'm a long way from home, line with every cliched variation imaginable. Shelton dutifully regurgitated what he heard to credulous Times readers. Shelton was to Dylan what the Bosnian Franciscans were to the seers of Medjugorje, which was a miracle that E. Michael Jones destroyed, or he reported that it was fake. I'll read that again. Shelton was to Dylan what the Bosnian Franciscans were to the seers of Medjugorje in Yugoslavia. He was the authority that gave an air of plausibility to the secular equivalent of the phony apparition. The urban Jew is the avatar of the 30s Okie. The important thing was not what Dylan said, but that someone with the credibility of the secular clergy believed it. Once the secular clergy accepted his myth became a reality. That happened on September 28, 1961, when Shelton's article appeared in the New York Times. According to Spitz, Dylan read and reread the words in a state of shock. The first article ever written about him appeared in no less august a forum than the New York Times, quote, and it was a goddamn rave. A day later, Dylan went to the Columbia Recording Studios to play harmonica for Carolyn Hester, knowing producer John Hammond would be there to offer him a recording contract on the strength of Shelton's review. Hammond, quote, liked what he saw, the whole Dylan package, the angry young folk singer. It hit the right chord. Dylan got the contract. Dylan knew who the players in the folk were in the folk music scene and how to appeal to them. There was something artful about his deceptions and something methodically calculating about them, too. Within weeks, Dylan was sleeping with a 17-year-old Italian girl, Susie Rotolo. He was also sleeping on the couch at her sister's apartment, and her sister, Carla Rotolo, was secretary to Alan Lomax, the guy who basically invented the modern country movement, as he said in the other chapter. I'm not sure why he didn't jam all these together into one super chapter the way he did earlier in the book, because the chapters talk about multiple different things in them, and it's not clear to see why he separated it as he did. But I guess that doesn't really matter, because his stuff is his stuff. 1961, Ramblin' Jack Elliott returns. In 1961, Ramblin' Jack Elliott returned to America after a six-year sojourn in England and Europe. The folk music was a cultural craze sweeping the nation. Elliott's timing was exquisite. A new generation born after the war and bred in prosperity was looking for a leader on whom they could shower money and adulation. Elliott, 15 years their senior, looked the logical candidate. It was like the Messiah coming down from heaven, said Izzy Young, broker of folk music and messianic politics, describing Elliott's return to Greenwich Village. When Ramblin' Jack traveled to New Jersey to visit Woody in the hospital, he found considerable competition for Woody's mantle as the uncontested leader of the folk music movement. While attending the gathering that the Gleasons arranged every Sunday so Woody's army of fans could serenade him, Elliott met Bob Dylan. Dylan ingratiated himself with the returned idol. He told Elliott he had all of Jack's records. He then began to hang around with Elliott as obsequiously as Elliott 10 years before had hung around with Guthrie. Dylan couldn't move in with Elliott's family because Elliott didn't have one, so he moved in next door to him at the Earl Hotel. When Dylan played his first gig at Gertie's Folk City, he was billed as the son of Jack Elliott, which wasn't particularly flattering to Dylan or to Elliott either. When Dylan's career took off and Elliott stalled, Elliott bore his young imitator no ill will because he was simply following in Elliott's footsteps. Sounding like Woody Guthrie had become a Jewish tradition by 1962. What distinguished the two men was not their musical styles as much as their attitudes toward their careers. Elliott seems to have taken to heart the essential message of deracinated folk music. I'm a rambler, I'm a gambler, I'm a long way from home, by living that life himself. Elliott had rambled all over Europe and lost his first wife when she put down roots in a kibbutz in Israel. Ramblin' Jack just kept on rambling, which meant he didn't stay put even when he got back to Greenwich Village, which was not a smart career move at the time. He stayed only long enough to be greeted like a god at a series of sold-out concerts. He was anointed by the secular clergy, praised by Newsweek as authentic. He was anointed by the high priest of the folk movement, Robert Shelton, who claimed this son of a Jewish doctor from Brooklyn had, quote, a remarkable ear for the speech and sounds of the American plains, and that he had, quote, thoroughly mastered the idiom of genuine American folk music, Mr. Elliot, Shelton concluded, doesn't know where the road of the future will take him. Some observers think that with stern direction he could channel his drifting and parlay his colorful demeanor and rich musical talents into a stage personality of great popular appeal. Stern direction, however, was the last thing on Ramblin' Jack's mind. Unlike Ramblin' Jack, Bob Dylan was smart enough not to believe his own lyrics or take the persona he was cultivating for public consumption too seriously. Dylan's obsession with persona and image made him inscrutable, which further enhanced his image. I never knew when he was playing a role or being himself, said folk singer Mark Spolstra. Dylan read the lifestyle needs of his audience and tailored his music to them. The folk music of the popular front did not fit the lifestyle of the baby boomers. When Henry Ford died in 1947, his grandson broke with the family tradition of hiring goons to beat up union organizers. With the auto workers as a model, the nation enjoyed cooperation between labor and management, which brought unparalleled prosperity. The workers' children raised during the Dylan era would have a hard time relating to the ballad of Joe Hill and Solidarity Forever. They needed new music, or at least new lyrics, to address the big issues of the day, and as Ron Radosh indicated, the avant-garde of the cultural proletariat had decided to get involved in sexual liberation. In September 1961, Rod Radosh and his wife returned to Madison, where he hoped to earn a Ph.D. in history under William Appleton Williams, whom he describes as an authentic American radical, i.e. not Jewish. Soon, a very thin young kid with traces of baby fat on him showed up looking for a place to stay. The young kid, Bob Dylan, got Radosh's name and address from Carl Granich, a friend and awesome guitar picker from the Young Communist Circle in New York City. Dylan and Radosh shared a desire to subvert what they saw as the inhuman institutions of an incipiently fascist America. Dylan did not stay with Radosh. He was sent down the road to the apartment of Danny Kalb, who later formed the late 60s variation on the Jewish folk singer, the Jewish Blues Band. Where Bob Dylan spent the night was irrelevant. In Madison, he lived in the Wisconsin equivalent of Jewish Bohemia. He fit in by playing the guitar at the regular impromptu hootenanny sessions at a small new cafe on State Street, modeled on Greenwich Village hangouts. Dylan wasn't yet a star. Indeed, he took a backseat to Radosh, who performed as an agitprop ballad by Irwin Silber, quote, talkin' un-American blues, which attacked the House Un-American Activities Committee in the style of Woody Guthrie. The song delighted Dylan, who added it to his repertoire. Dylan then sang a few Guthrie songs, including New York Town, which must have resonated with Radosh, the New Yorker in exile. Radosh says Dylan was actually too ready to pick up his guitar. At one party, he was told, Bob, would you put the damn guitar away already? Nobody wants to hear you anymore. Dylan meekly put his guitar away and left Madison for New York. Dylan claimed he was a rambler and a gambler and a long way from home, but only when it fostered his career. Radosh was understandably skeptical when Dylan told him, with a tone of complete assurance, that he was going to be as big a star as Elvis Presley. Dylan insisted, No, you'll see, I'll play the same and even bigger arenas, I know it. Destiny, Dylan said of his life in 1961, was about to manifest itself. It was looking right at me and nobody else. It was looking right at me and nobody else. Often, as in the 60 Minutes interview following the release of his first volume of his autobiography, Dylan spoke as if he had been singled out by the powers of the world to fulfill some cosmic design. The zeitgeist needed someone bright enough to put two and two together, or at the very least to write new lyrics to the old melodies. The sexual revolutionaries would soon run into the same problem that their parents encountered. Wildwood Flower still wasn't a revolutionary melody. And it was even less appropriate for sexual revolution than it had been for the popular front. To update the music of the popular front, Bob Dylan had to tap into the cultural aquifer that produced the tourists that inundated the village every weekend. The Kingston Trio was popular, but culturally irrelevant. Pete Seeger had been relevant, but the popular front was long dead and gone. Because he was a Jew working in the Jewish folk music subset of the Jewish popular music industry, Dylan could count on a sympathetic hearing when he articulated his deepest feelings of rebellion or revolution. Nothing seemed to delight Bob more than undermining the power of an authority figure, one biographer says. In this regard, Dylan was only doing what other Jews had done before him, Marx and Freud and Reich. And what they were going to do with more gusto as he redefined folk music in places like Manny Roth's, uncle of rocker David Lee Roth of Van Halen, club The Wha, W-H-A, question mark, as the vehicle for the cultural revolution with a little help from his friends. So every single genre across the board, music, art, literature, painting, architecture, politics, psychology, science, social science, Jews are redefining in revolutionary terms to benefit their race. Dylan's biggest friend in this regard was a self-described, quote, Jewish businessman from Chicago by the name of Albert Grossman. Grossman, according to Spitz, was neither gentleman nor political, but rather a Jewish businessman. He was a cagey operator who lived by the Teutonic theory that those who struck first and fastest usually eat best. Grossman claimed to have graduated from the University of Chicago, which was not true, and to have walked away from a career in Chicago city government, which was also not true. He did, however, manage a folk club there and was astute enough to understand that the future of the musical movement lay in Greenwich Village, where he arrived shortly after Ramblin' Jack Elliott and Bob Dylan. Dave Van Ronk, approached early on by Grossman, called him an astute but very cruel man, extraordinarily cruel in a very cold and calculated way, who went out of his way to corrupt the performers he represented. Grossman played a kind of Mephistophelian role with young village folk singers. He guaranteed them stardom in return for their integrity. Grossman approached Van Ronk to see if he were interested in becoming part of a folk supergroup trio, which he planned to manage. Grossman saw a large gap between commercially successful but insipid groups like the Kingston Trio and the authentic but commercially unappealing imitators of Woody Guthrie. Grossman's solution was a trio. Peter, Paul, and Mary, PP&M, combined the talents of a stand-up comic, Noel Stuckey, who changed his name to the vaguely religious-sounding Paul, a singer, Peter Yarrow, and Mary Travers, the sexually liberated platinum blonde bombshell from the Elizabeth Irwin School. Van Ronk was Grossman's first choice as Mary's foil, but to get into the act, Van Ronk had to change my name to Olaf, the blues singer, wear a helmet with horns growing out of it, and pretend to be blind. Van Ronk had to be willing to make a fool of himself on stage because integrity bothered Albert, who used to say that there was no such thing as an honest man. It was merely a question of finding out what my price was, even if it cost him $300,000 of his own money. That was the kind of guy Albert really was. Dave Van Ronk, 5 years older than Dylan, was an established figure in the village when Dylan arrived. In his autobiography, Dylan describes meeting Van Ronk under the watchful eye of Izzy Young. Dylan describes Van Ronk as singing songs originally sung by singers who seemed to be groping for words, almost in an alien tongue. Van Ronk had recorded his first album in 1959 for Folkways Records, a company founded by Moses Ash, and one of the critical links between the popular front and the folk song revival of the 60s. From a broken family in Brooklyn, Van Ronk was taught by vicious Irish nuns in Queens. Originally a merchant seaman who sang songs and played the guitar, the blossoming folk music craze changed that. Odetta listened to him and suggested he make a demo tape and send it to Albert Grossman. Van Ronk hitchhiked to Chicago to present the tape and perform for Grossman, but their personalities never meshed, possibly because of ethnic differences, although the suggestion that he change his name to Olaf the blues singer didn't help. The persona of the urban folk singer had already been set, and it was cryptically Jewish, not Dutch/Irish Catholic. Van Ronk abandoned the religion of his youth for socialism, but abandoning his ethnic identity proved more difficult. Paradoxically, the compatibility between Grossman and Dylan lay in their shared ethnic identity they had abandoned, or perhaps reworked, with the zeitgeist in mind. Spitz says Grossman, quote, much like his protege Bobby Dylan, developed a new persona by concocting an apocryphal autobiography. And he helped Dylan do the same thing. Bob Gibson, a successful folk singer managed by Grossman, didn't come up with a proper image either. The Goyim were finding it difficult to compete as cultural revolutionaries. The revolutionary Jews had an advantage, especially since music promoters shared their views. According to Gibson, Grossman gave highest priority to class, quote-unquote, which meant that you had to embody Albert's elitist tendencies, which also meant taking regular instruction and criticism from him and assuming aspects of his personality. That meant combining the Jewish businessman with messianic cultural politics, because, as Gibson notes, Albert envisioned himself as a cultural messiah. Grossman wanted to get rich off his singers, but in order to do so, he first had to, quote, create a legend. To elevate the enthusiasm of the folk music fans flooding into college campuses to a level that separated his new client from every other performer so that no comparisons could be drawn. The Cultural Revolution had officially begun, and God help the folk singer who couldn't conceptualize his own myth. Bob Dylan was in a class all by himself, and Albert Grossman was going to make damn sure that he remained there by promoting the Dylan mystique, as he referred to it. Bob Dylan's first album was released in March 1962, earning a glowing pseudonymous endorsement by the fawning Robert Shelton. He wrote under the name Stacy Williams because it would have been regarded as unethical for New York Times critics to objectively review an album that carried his byline on the back cover, especially in light of payola scandals. The album consisted of covers of folk tunes popular in Greenwich Village, including a version of House of the Rising Sun, appropriated without permission from Dave Van Ronk. His only original piece, a tribute to Woody Guthrie, lifted Woody's melody from a song written about a 1913 mining disaster that Ramblin' Jack Elliott popularized. Dylan's original music first appeared in the spring of 1963 when the Freewheelin' Bob Dylan album was released, with a picture on its cover of him and Susie Rotolo walking down Great Jones Street together. Don't Think Twice, It's All Right was the album's biggest hit, and, like the cover photo of the two, it involves Susie Rotolo, who had gone to Europe at the urging of her mother. Dylan was desolate. The song has a clear emotional and musical focus that disappeared from his music when Dylan later joined the Sexual Revolution. He would then sing indistinguishable songs about indistinguishable women. But in 1963, the revolution hadn't taken place yet. He could still focus one song on one woman. And we're now on 880. We got 1.5 pages left in this chapter. When Dylan's third album, The Times They Are A-Changing, was released in February 1964, The Plastic Demons of Decomposition is what Richard Wagner called Jews. And how we see in Dylan how protean they are, and his producer Grossman, how protean they are. When Dylan's third album, The Times They Are A-Changing, was released in February 1964, the revolutionary cat was out of the bag. Even though written in the folk mode, the title song had clear revolutionary intent, tailored specifically to the generation that was then coming of age and buying lots of records in their search for a new lifestyle identity. The music was different enough, a weird G chord to an insistent strum and forthright harmonica, which disguised the standard G, C, D progression. Again, Jones does his own music, his own homemade music, to add urgency to the lyrics, which were undeniably powerful. No more Popular Front Working Men, but rather a denunciation of parents. Your sons and daughters are beyond your command. Your old road is rapidly aging. Come get out of the new one if you can't lend a hand, for the times, they are a-changing. It wasn't the Fugs. It wasn't Dionysian excess, but it didn't throw cold water on the disordered passions either. It ennobled those passions by associating them with the civil rights movement, messianic politics, and a host of equally revolutionary themes. Everyone was blown away by the bard who made Jewish revolution plausible in a peculiarly American way. Dylan's next four albums established him as the spokesman of his generation. To explain how Dylan revolutionized folk and popular music, Spitz mixes metaphors. Natural selection, he writes, had chosen Bob Dylan to be the high priest of protest singers. Then he calls Dylan an enlightened prophet. Finally, he settles on business metaphors, saying, beneath this scruffy folk exterior beat the heart of a Jewish businessman from Minnesota who knew the value of self-promotion, and in an offbeat way he courted the establishment crowd when he thought it could help his career. In a plutocratic society, it's unnecessary to distinguish between businessmen, political messiahs, and revolutionaries. One person can be all three. Or to put it succinctly, to succeed with your cultural revolution, you have to be all three rolled up in one. In America, it was all three rolled up in two, Bob Dylan and Albert Grossman. Once Peter, Paul, and Mary proved folk music could pull in mainstream money, recording contracts began to pour into Greenwich Village. Dave Van Ronk noticed that all of a sudden there was money all over the place. From 1960 to 1965, recording company executives began handing out major label recording contracts like they were coming in Cracker Jack boxes. People had been sleeping on floors and eating in cafeterias in a year or two before, all of a sudden had enough money to buy a suit if they wanted to. Mark Spolstra pinpoints the change in folk music from something practiced by sincere amateurs to something controlled by the music industry to a specific week in 1962. He went to visit friends in Canada, and when he got back, Bob Dylan and his friends were sitting around talking big bucks. You'd have thought I walked in on a dinner party of wealthy industrialists. What the hell happened while I was in Toronto? The object of our closely knit folk community had always been to sing and have fun, and suddenly it seemed as if everything had changed. Spitz claimed that the point at which folk music merged with show business could actually be seen by the human eye. The notion that folk singers and money were incompatible became obsolete. Bob Dylan was to become the well-paid poet-philosopher of his generation, someone who could satisfy young middle-class Jewish intellectuals' hunger for someone to put ideas into their heads. Bob Dylan's revolutionary music arrived not a moment too soon because the other side of the collective Jewish personality in America, the Jewish comedian, had been subverting the folk scene by making it look ridiculous. In 1962, Alan Sherman released his album, My Son the Folk Singer. Dylan was no stranger to parodies of Jewish folk singers. His Talkin' Havana Gila Blues is a case in point. But Sherman took the tradition established by Mickey Katz and his kosher jammers to a new level precisely when the folk bubble was threatening to burst. Jewish involvement in the resurrection of popular front Appalachian or Negro music was a satirical target too big to ignore, and many scored direct hits, including Shel Silverstein in his parody, Folk Singer's Blues, which talked about what to do when, and the only Levy you know is the Levy who lives on the block. Yes, the only Levy you know is the Levy who lives on the block. The disparity was too big to ignore. Young middle-class Jews singing about picking cotton in Mississippi was prime comedy material. If folk music was to survive the assaults of Alan Sherman singing Catskill Ladies, Sing Your Song, Doo-Dah, Doo-Dah, it needed different lyrics and more Dionysian music to fit the mores of a new generation of Jews who went to camp not to sing folk songs around a campfire, but to have sex with a Negro lifeguard. Bob Dylan provided that music. More importantly, Dylan provided the new persona of the folk singing revolutionary, new persona that enabled others to make the music too. He set a paragon for them, a model. He gave ideas to them. What folk music needed, according to Spitz, were performers who were willing to invest in it something unique and intensely personal, rather than simply recycling labor movement songs in the style of Woody Guthrie. That music was no longer vital to the younger generation. Bob Dylan was the zeitgeist on a motorcycle. By writing new folk songs, Bob had a chance to say something compelling about the current scene and comment on his own life and times. And that concludes the chapter. Pretty darn remarkable. Early 60s, Dylan inventing himself, plastic, completely plastic, sampling, emulating, copying, and shrewdly forecasting, promoting, planning very carefully, at the same time appearing to be studied unstudiedness, as they might say about the matter of hairstyle or dress. Fascinating stuff. Anyway, I want to thank you for being with me, and I'll be back with you again real soon.